Ciao, benvenuti. Welcome to Choc Tops and Cassata, the podcast that takes a peek into the way migrants got their fix of Italian movies from World War II to the advent of SBS in the early 80s.
This is a Secret Life of Language podcast from the School of Languages and Linguistics at the University of Melbourne. I'm Elisabetta Ferrari, lecturer in Italian Studies at the University of Melbourne.
I'm Mark Nichols. I research and teach in film in the School of Culture and Communications at the University of Melbourne.
And I'm Santo Cilauro. I'm not a lecturer in anything. I'm a writer, I'm a filmmaker, and an unashamed connoisseur of all Italian B-grade movies, regardless of where they were made. Sicily, Calabria, or way up north in Naples. Now tell us, Elisabetta, why are we here?
We are here because between the 50s and the end of the 70s, Melbourne was home to more than 16 Italian language cinemas.
Wow, 16.
Yes, and these cinemas represented for a great number of Italians migrating to Australia a very important way to connect to their cultural heritage. But also they provided significant social and recreational opportunities for these Italians.
Right. Okay, so let's get going. Mark?
I had two transformative experiences recently. The first was not so long ago. I went to a screening of the 70s horror classic Carrie at the Thornbury Picture House. The other transformative experience was to sit in a cinema and watch a film called The Lost City of Melbourne. And we are absolutely stoked because we have the director of one of those transformative experiences and the purveyor, the exhibitor, the distributor, well, exhibitor, I think is the way we might describe him, Gus Berger here. He has been involved in all sorts of different interesting exhibition contexts, both in Melbourne and also abroad. What's the title of your role at Thornbury Picture House?
It could be owner-operator, would be an old-fashioned title for what I do, but that's not very fair on my wife, who's also kind of an owner-operator. Operator as well.
So, yes, your wife Lou. Yes. Smooth operators, I would like to call
Thank
it.
You.
Certainly, the Thornbury Picture House in Melbourne has become very quickly a great institution for people to see screen films the way they should be screened. So that's a really
in a petrol station,
in a former petrol station. Yeah, but also let's not forget Gus's incredible film, The Lost City of Melbourne. The screening I was at was such a joy, and for those of us who know Melbourne or who grew up here, it was an incredible experience. So we are very pleased to have Gus to come and talk to us as an expert on so many of these matters that are important to us and important to this podcast. So it's really nice to have you here. Thanks for coming in, Gus.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me.
First of all, Gus, why did you make the film?
It was kind of linked to a project that I did a few years earlier when we first opened Thornbury Picture House. And I've always been interested in the old cinemas and theatres of Melbourne, particularly wherever I've lived. So whether it's St Kilda or Richmond or Brunswick, I've always sought out those old cinemas and theatres and where they once stood and what's happened to them and what's in their place now if they have been demolished. So I made this 2-minute short film that we play at Thornbury Picture House. It was called The Lost Cinemas of the North, and it was just a 2-minute montage of photographs of old cinemas that used to stand, and some still standing, Coburg, Northcote, Preston, Thornbury, Brunswick, and just with their names, photos, and music underneath it. It's like a 2-minute sort of thing. So when the lockdowns started and our cinema was closed, I sort of went back to that project and think, I wonder if there's something more in that. I wonder if there's maybe a short doco in the old cinemas of Melbourne or the old cinemas of the North or Brunswick or something like that. So it started there and it kind of evolved as the lockdowns kept going and we just kept having to close our doors, read more and got deeper into the archives and realised that there was a bigger story potentially here than just the old cinemas of the North, if you like.
Okay, so that's the why, but why is it important?
I think it's important for people to know what Melbourne was like, what we had, what we lost, and potentially as a bit of a sort of a subtle call to action about what we can still hold on to.
So, Gus, your film The Lost City of Melbourne looks at the destruction of many of the city's grandest buildings, including some of Melbourne's finest cinemas. Would you say that the push to modernization happened in the lead-up to the Melbourne Olympic Games in 1956?
when I discovered more about the buildings that we'd lost and what was happening in Melbourne in the 50s and 60s, there was that perfect storm that we talk about of cultural cringe, the Olympic Games and television. For me, that was all intertwined. Well, it was all happening at the same time, all part of that sort of storm. So I guess that if it wasn't for the introduction of TV in 56, the same year as the Olympic Games, same year as that call for progress on the streets, then I probably wouldn't have included the cinemas and theatres, but they were just so linked to that storm because of the introduction of television, which had such a big impact on the future and of theatre cinemas.
Certainly 56 has a lot to answer for in this context.
And interestingly, I guess that coincided with mass migration from Europe in that sort of mid-50s into the 60s. So I guess we were lucky that there was that input of people, because I don't know how many of those cinemas actually would have survived beyond 5 or 10 years after 56 had it not been for people that needed to watch their movies again.
When television arrived in 1956, attendance dropped at Melbourne's suburban cinemas and many closed. But migrant communities saw an opportunity to lease the buildings cheaply and screen films in their own languages. At this time, access to non-English media was very limited. The heyday of Melbourne's Italian language cinemas lasted from the late 1950s through to the 70s. But when the federal government established the Special Broadcasting Service, SBS, everything changed again. In 1980, a new television station known as Channel 028 screened films and programs in Italian and other community languages. The suburban cinemas experienced a second death. Some were demolished, but some survived.
I think if it wasn't for Greek and Italian cinemas, we probably would have lost them all.
We would have lost them all.
I think so.
Okay.
I mean, maybe we would have had a couple, maybe one or two in each northern suburb, southern suburb, one in the city. But I think that if it wasn't for that population of keeping those films alive, because quite simply that's what they became, Greek, showing Greek and Italian movies. I doubt the Astor would still be standing, you know, and certainly Italian cinemas on Lygon Street in East Brunswick, we would have lost them all too. I've gone into many of those old theatres on Lygon Street and in Coburg and to see whether, you know, there could be a resurrection of an old cinema, if they had any of the things that you need these days to kind of continue a cinema business and run it at a profit and pay your rent. But many of them have had levels put in the middle of them. Like, you know, they're two-story buildings with a one-story enterprise going on in there. So they would put in a floor and make economic sense. There's no going back because the ceiling levels are now too low for a cinema.
Gus, can I ask you if there was one building that you could step back into from that era?
I'm always drawn as a cinema operator and someone who loves cinema and film and history of theatres in this country to the Padua.
I would have to agree, because I've seen some of the design of the Padua and some of the images, and it looked like an amazing cinema. And in fact, I did a bit of research on the Padua, and it was a really large cinema, 1,800 seats on Sydney Road, Brunswick. And it was designed in a streamlined modern style. It had a Hammond electric organ, a revolving stage, and it actually operated from 1937 until 1968 by Hoyth. A year later, in 1969, the building was leased to Antonio and Franco Zeccola, who used the cinema to screen Italian language films up until 1981, but they renamed it the Metropolitan. Eventually, it was demolished and it actually was replaced by a supermarket.
I've looked at drawings in a lot of detail, and I mean, it also had a roof garden, which I didn't mention in the film. There is a photo of like a little terrace that people probably just went up in there and smoked a cigarette and looked out. You would have had a great views of the city, top there of Sydney Road, and obviously of the ticket booth, which was this futuristic thing.
It was shaped like a spacecraft, you know, something like out of a sci-fi movie. The Padua was only one of more than a dozen Italian language cinemas in Melbourne. There was the Cinema Italia in Clifton Hill, the Colosseo in Ascot Vale, the Teatro Moderno in East Brunswick, La Scala in Footscray, the Locus Sinister in North Melbourne, the Mayfair in Dandenong, the Pix in Norbert Park, and the Vesuvio in Flemington, not to consider all of the one that would have been also in Country Victoria.
It's funny how Italians seem to have a preferred cinema, even though my family grew up in the Clifton Hill and Collingwood area. My father liked to go to La Scala in Footscray.
Oh, that's funny, isn't it?
He just liked going there.
Did he go to the Padua?
To the Metropolitan, yes, because we had cousins and things there. Mm. But I haven't asked him whether he's seen it in its full architectural glory with the space age.
Yeah, the ticket booth. Ticket,
because I think that may have gone by the time.
Yes, it was the Metropolitan, I think.
I think it may have gone.
Yeah. The search is still on for that ticket booth, by the way. Apparently.
Is that right?
Oh. Not a wadding. City Council randomly purchased it at one of the wrecking auctions. And then the trail went dead. So they had it for a while in the late 80s, and no one knows where it's gone.
Oh, that wouldn't be so interesting. That's certainly a cinema that you would want to have back. Because it was architecturally stunning.
Well, interesting you should say that, Elisabetta, because I have a friend who is makes model buildings and things like that, and he makes replicas, and he loved the Padua, and he found the architectural drawings, which are in the State Library of Victoria, including the actual drawings for the ticket booth. So technically, it could be rebuilt brick by brick.
Cinema theatres like the Metropolitan had state-of-the-art interior fittings and amenities, including foot warmers, a crying room for parents,
really?
Attending sessions with children.
I didn't know that.
I don't just lament the loss of the buildings from an architecture point of view. I lament them for the loss of them from a community point of view, because it's always been for me trying to also put value on what was happening within those buildings and going back in time, imagining how they were being used. And people have just got this really strong memories and emotions, particularly with cinema. So, it was a very important thing to do with families. It was the outing with Friday and Saturday nights. Family day was Saturday, and it was singles night on Friday night, where it all be just groups of gangs of pushers and kids and stuff going to the films. But then it was families on the Saturdays.
And there's also a strong element of date night with chaperones and all sorts of things going on in places. Though, in fact, I got to say,
as we saw in Death in Brunswick,
Death in Brunswick, absolutely.
The old progress. And that's still standing.
Well, for those of you who don't know, Death in Brunswick is an iconic Australian film directed by John Ryan and Sam Neill. Sam Neill and Zoe Carides may have been that. So early 90s or late 80s.
John Clarke too.
John Clarke may have written it. Was he in it? Yeah, he was in it as well. Anyway, just get back to it.
There was a little window of time when these cinemas could survive. They had a perfect audience of newly arrived Italians that didn't have anywhere else where to watch any Italian content. And so these large venues, they would really watch whatever film was screened.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't
whatever
have whatever. We know that a lot of the screening were these Italian film screens, there were B-rated movies.
That was at the very most. There were B's or C's. Oh, no, they were horrible.
Good night.
Yeah, exactly. Then again, there was no competition. What it was. And that was the only. And I think that it wasn't really much, as we were saying before, about the films. Maybe it became very much about a social gathering and a social occasion for migrants newly arrived in Australia.
Strange little cycle, though, because the more time you spend at places like Italian cinemas, where that becomes your community, so my grandfather never got better at English. My dad did because I guess he worked here more. But I think a lot of those people didn't, because they were able to find a comfort in their own community experiences like they did in Italy. But there is so little documentation. There aren't that many photos of Italian people at the Metropolitan.
No.
There's no pictures of people.
It's funny, actually, because when I was making this project as a cinema operator, and certainly through lockdowns, there were cinema operators that were all kind of talking to each other. I emailed the CEO of Palo Zekeles, Benjamin Zekeles, son of Antonio Zekeles, who repurposed the Metropolitan, and said, do you have any photographs of the Metropolitan, exterior, interior, what have you got? Ended up speaking to his sister, and his sister put me on to someone else. And basically, the long and the short of it is I could not get a single photo, you know, full credit to them for trying, and they certainly tried, but they couldn't find any photos of people in the foyer.
It's interesting. In the research that we've done on Italian cinemas, there are incredibly few photos of people in the foyers.
Like, it just wasn't a thing to take photographs of you and your family and the operators outside the front of your place of business. And in fact, a lot of the photographs that are in the film of the cinemas were commissioned by Hoyts and in the 40s. There was a photographer, Adrian Crothers, who was paid by Hoyts to go and document exterior, interior of all of their cinemas in Victoria. Interestingly, they didn't want anyone in those photos. So yes, the photos of the Padua and the Regent are all like, you know, taken empty, just this is what they look like. This is the interior, how grand it is and all of that. You know, lo and behold, there'd be no one in any of them. And if there was, they're probably told to move along so the photographer could take, you know, it's interesting, isn't it?
Santo, you were mentioning your grandfather before. Tell us a little bit more about that experience.
I think my grandfather was the last person to go to the Cinema Italia. He was literally the last person in there. It would have been about 83 or something like that. You know, it was a downer for him, but I think they all moved on. Italians are pretty good at moving on. You know, they don't sit there and go, okay, we'll protest this until that reopens. So I did ask my dad last night, actually. I said, if it weren't for the Italian cinemas, where could you watch Italian films? He said, I don't think they were on anywhere.
And then along came SBS.
But I do remember when SBS Channel O was first introduced. I think it was 28. You know, I'd be interested to know what effect that had. I mean, I'm
killed it.
It was the death knell. Yeah.
But maybe there is another element to consider is the fact that in that space of 10, 15 years after the migrant arrived and we're getting towards the 70s, their proficiency with the English language would have improved enormously. Mm. So by that time, I imagine that a lot of people that had migrated would be able to also attend English-speaking films.
That's interesting, yeah. So we've established that, I guess in some part, migrants watching film was a bit of a reprieve for these buildings, as in that they were saved. I guess the question is, what are we doing now to preserve them?
Look, I think they're getting better. We've now got heritage, we've got legislation that protects the interior buildings as well. So that's a step forward. And I do understand that cities are in this constant flux of change as they grow and they develop. But, you know, I'm just, you know, scared to death that that image of the city will change again. And I don't know. Like, you know, I guess you've got to keep moving forward. But I mean, that was the rallying cry that brought them all down in the first place. No. So I don't want to have to say that.
Yeah, so I suppose it brings up that whole question about how we're using our buildings and our cinemas and how we want to deal with the past, what we're saying about the past, whether we want to knock them down or leave it all there, kind of warts and all.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it kind of exposes what we were and what we're wanting to be. I mean, obviously, this is a huge question and probably exactly the kind of thing we'll be talking about in each of our podcasts. Nothing we can sort out in the next 5 minutes. But if for everyone listening, this is your take-home homework. Think about these issues and we'll keep discussing as we go on. So it's been an absolutely fantastic opportunity for us, Gus, to have you with us. And we really appreciate you coming in. And what I kept thinking throughout your discussion is that your history is our history, so hopefully we can keep up the discussion, and it's been great to have you. Thanks very much for coming along.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's been really nice talking to you all.
You have been listening to Chop Tops and Cassata, an episode of The Secret Life of Language. Special thanks to our guest, Gus Berger, and our producer and editor, Alice Garner. The Secret Life of Language is recorded and mixed at the Horwood Recording Studio by Gavin Nabel. It is a podcast from the School of Languages and Linguistics at the University of Melbourne. Chop Tops and Cassata would not be possible without the support of the Australasian Centre for Italian Studies. Be sure to keep up with every episode of The Secret Life of Language by following us on the Apple Podcast app, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. The Secret Life of Language is licensed under Creative Commons.